The following message was preached at Redeemer Community Church. For more information about Redeemer, visit us online at www.redeemernc.org.
Today's scripture reading comes from Ecclesiastes 9:16 through 10:2. And I said, "Wisdom is better than strength, but the wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words are not heeded. The calm words of the wise are heeded more than the shouts of a ruler over fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner can destroy much good. Dead flies make a perfumer's oil ferment and stink, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. A wise person's heart goes to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. This is the word of the Lord."
You may be seated. Thanks, Jenny. I went to a small liberal arts college in Wisconsin, and that experience shaped my view of college professors. So there, the professors were teachers who spent time in the classroom or with office hours for their students. And it wasn't until I moved to the Research Triangle almost 20 years ago that I learned there was another type of professor. There are professors who spend the majority of their time doing research. Right, they don't really like to spend time in the classroom. They turn that over to graduate assistants. They want to do research. Well, the teacher who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes combines these two types of professors into one. So chapters 1 through 8 are his research, and in chapters 9 through 12, he transitions to the classroom to deliver his finding to the students. Maybe you can picture this way, that between chapter 8 and chapter 9, he takes off his lab coat and he puts on his tweed jacket. So before last week, what we did is we observed him as he did experiments, conducted research on the meaning and purpose of life, and now, beginning last week, he began to share those conclusions with us. So the first conclusion, the beginning of chapter 9, was that if we're going to enjoy the life that God gives us, we first have to recognize that we're going to die, that life is short. And once we accept that, then we can begin to make the most of the life that we've received from God. So just picture the teacher now. He's given his first lecture. He's learned all of this information. He's given his first lecture. And now he looks out at his students. And he realizes that his students fall primarily into two groups. There's one group. This is probably the minority of students. They're the ones that are seeking wisdom. They're trying to make wise choices. The second group, sadly, much larger than the first, is made up of fools. They're not concerned about being wise. They're really just concerned about doing whatever it is they feel like doing. And of course, there are some students stuck in the middle, and it's not always sure which students are which. They don't wear name tags saying, "Hi, I'm a fool." But most of his students, as he looks out, it seems that they've chosen one path or the other. So here he is, the teacher, and in our text this morning, what he does is he looks out at these students. He looks at the group of wise students. He looks at the foolish students, and he says, "I've got a warning for both of you. I've done this research. I've come to some important conclusions, and from these conclusions, I want each group to take some notes." So we find the warning to the wise in chapter 9, and we find a warning to the fools in chapter 10. So let's begin with a warning to the wise. If you remember back to chapter 7 and 8, we visited the lab with the teacher. Do you remember he put wisdom and foolishness on the microscope and he examined it? And now he's bringing these observations into the classroom. What does he want us to know? And here's his warning to the wise. Your life is not in your control. Your life is not in your control. That wisdom is wonderful. It benefits your life. You should pursue it. You should seek it. It gives more blessings than you can count. But if you think being wise allows you to control your life, then you're sadly mistaken. So in verse 11, he lists five types of people. And the one in the middle is the wise. It's really the focus of this observation. And each of these five individuals expects a certain outcome, and each one is disappointed. And his point he's making in listing these five groups is simply to say your life is not in your control. So look at chapter 9, verse 11. He said, "Again, I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, or bread to the wise, or riches to the discerning, or favor to the skillful, Rather, time and chance happened to all of them. So why does the track star spend so much time preparing for the championship race, right? So she'll win it. Does that guarantee she's going to win it? No, it doesn't. Well, why does a certain country spend so much money on their military? It's so that if they ever get in a battle, they're going to win it. But does it guarantee that they're going to win it? No, it doesn't. So wisdom dictates that the one who is most prepared is supposed to win, whether it's a race or a battle or a contract or a prize. But life doesn't work that way. If you watch much sports, then you probably heard this line that announcers love to say. They love to say something like this: well, this team is better on paper. And they pause, and sort of like a dad joke, they always say the same next line: but games aren't played on paper. And what they're saying is that you can look at all the measurables, and this team looks bigger and more talented and more skilled, and their record's better, and everything you would write down if you're writing a pros and cons, the pros go in their favor, they're going to win. Then they get out on the field, and what happens? Well, most time they win, but not every time, not 100% of the time. One team may be better, may be more skilled, more be prepared, but they might still lose. So why can't the right kind of preparation, the wise preparation, why can't it guarantee success? And that's the answer, verse 11. Time and chance happen to them all. That there are certain things outside of our control, specifically time and chance. We can't control what will happen or when it will happen. So the track star, she can get ready for the big race, do everything in her power to be prepared for that race. And the night before the race, it might rain, and the track might be just a little bit slippery, and she might take a step, and she might slip, and she loses the race. She can do everything to get ready for the race, and the week before the race, at her tune-up event, as she's nearing the finish line, she may feel a little twinge in her leg, and all of a sudden, she's not healthy enough to race in the big race. Or maybe she does everything, and everything's going well, and what she doesn't know is she's got a competitor who's on steroids. And so she loses the race unfairly. Or maybe it's an Olympic year, and she has worked her whole life to win the Olympics, and she's the favorite to win, and then her government boycotts the Olympic Games, and she doesn't get to participate. See, far more is out of her control than is in it. One researcher noticed that more than 40% of elite Canadian hockey players were born between January and March. And this surprised them. It seems like it should be more evenly distributed. So only about 25% should have been born in those 3 months, but it was over 40. So they looked into it, and what they realized is that the cutoff date for leagues for kids was December 31st. And so that meant that in all those years growing up, in all of those leagues they played in, they were always the oldest. And when you're 6 or 7 or 8 years old, an extra 8 to 10 months of size and strength and coordination can make a big difference. And so the researcher's conclusion was that it isn't always the one who is the most talented. Sometimes it's just a matter of being born in the right month. See, we know that time is out of our control. Right? This is why we will say something like, well, he was just in the right place at the right time. Or, man, it was really bad timing. Like that entrepreneur may have a great idea, but the reason it fails is not because of anything that was their fault. It just came to the market at the wrong time. See, time is out of our control. We can't stop it. We can't slow it down. We can't speed it up. We can't control it. We can't predict it. This was research that we saw earlier. If we remember back to chapter 3, when he was doing the research and doing the experiments, he was talking about how unpredictable the seasons of life were, and he said this, right? A time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to give birth, a time to die. For everything, there is a season. So time is out of our control. But it's not just time. He says it's also chance, what we would call luck. Now, we're Christians. We don't use the word luck, but sometimes we do. And we're simply trying to refer to that thing that appears to be random. Like, why does one person take off work and the other person goes into work in New York City on September 11th, 2001? Why does one person, that friend of yours, when they go buy a car, they always seem to find an amazing deal? When you go buy a car, you always seem to find a lemon. Like, what is that? Like, why is there one house that's in the path of the tornado and another house just a block away has no damage? Like, time and chance. So I was talking to our favorite weatherman this week, and he mentioned that percentage that's next to the day's weather. You know the one I'm talking about, right? The one that gives the probability of rain on that day. And this is what he said. It's a quote. I wrote it down. Any percentage between 0 and 100 reflects an accuracy we don't have. I hope he doesn't get fired for that statement. What he says is, listen, for all the time, for all the money, all the energy we put into research, we really don't know what's going to happen. We can make some educated guesses, and maybe those guesses are right more often than they're wrong, but we don't know. It's out of our control. So the teacher in verse 12 selects two illustrations from nature to demonstrate this lack of control we have over our lives. Look at verse 12. For certainly no one knows his time. Like fish caught in a cruel net, or like birds caught in a trap. So people are trapped in an evil time as it suddenly falls on them. So imagine you're a fish and you're out for a nice swim. Like the sun has warmed the water. You're just enjoying this leisurely day, and out of nowhere, this net comes. It shatters the surface of the water. It drags you to the bottom where you're fighting desperately to free yourself, and you fail, and you're pulled wiggling and squirming into a boat where you struggle to breathe, and by nightfall, you're wrapped in rice and seaweed on someone's plate. He's like, that's how life works. We're minding our own business. We're trying to make good decisions. We're trying to live a wise life, and a net comes from nowhere and traps us. See, because we exist inside time and space, we don't see what's coming. That's the difference between being inside the corn maze and sort of standing on the platform above it. Inside it, we don't see the twists and turns and dead ends until we reach them. See, as much as we would like to be self-sufficient, as much as we'd like to chart the course for our lives, we're not in control. Even if we repeat that famous stanza, I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul. Listen, you're not the captain, you're the fish that's wiggling in the bottom of the boat. You're Nemo in a plastic bag. Like, wise choices don't bring time and chance under our control. So in 1993, the R&B group Color Me Bad, they released this hit song that's actually a reflection on verse 12. In fact, this song is called Time and Chance. And you can hear in it the frustration of not being able to control our own lives. It says, I'm trying to find the faith before the fall. A good man's down while a bad man's standing tall. A strong man don't always win them all. I'm going crazy, crazy, crazy. You see, the apparent randomness of life can make us feel like we're going crazy. He illustrates this feeling of frustration in a short story about a wise man who saved a city. Look at verse 13. I've observed that this also is wisdom under the sun. It is significant to me. There was a small city with few men in it. A great king came against it, surrounded it, and built large siege works against it. Now a poor wise man was found in the city, and he delivered the city by his wisdom. Yet no one remembered that poor man. And I said, wisdom is better than strength. But the wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words are not heeded. The calm words of the wise are heeded more than the shouts of a ruler over fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner can destroy much good. So there's a small city. Should have been destroyed by a mighty king, right? They were outgunned, outmanned, outnumbered, outplanned. And from nowhere comes this wise man who gives them the key to winning. And that's why he says in verse 16, wisdom is better than strength. And verse 18, that it's more powerful than weapons of war. And so what happened after the wise man delivered them? There was a parade, right? And he was in the final float. His name was sung about in songs. If you visit that little city, you'll see the statue of the wise man, right? I mean, he saved the city from destruction. But we're told in verse 15, actually what happens is they forget about him. Even though he saved him, they said his words were despised and ignored. And the point of this story is found in the final phrase of verse 18, but one sinner can destroy much good. As valuable as wisdom is, it does not give us control over our lives. There are people, including ourselves, who make sinful choices, and those sinful choices destroy everything. In fact, he began in verse 11 by saying that the bread goes to the wise man, right? But what happens to the wise man in this city? He doesn't get bread. He gets forgotten, despised. The story reminds me of Joseph, who's an imprisoned slave. He saves Egypt because of his wisdom, but we're told in Exodus 1 that a new king arises who does not know Joseph. He saved the city, saved the country, and no one remembered his name. Or Daniel, another imprisoned slave who served the king faithfully for decades, but the next king forgets all about him until a great enemy arises around the city, but by then it's too late for Daniel's wisdom to save the city. Most of all, it reminds you of Jesus, who humbled himself and became poor. And in a perfect display of wisdom, what he does is he rescues his people from this powerful enemy. And yet, what does the prophet tell us? He was despised and rejected by man, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And so, to the wise, the teacher gives this warning. Your life is not in your control. You, with all of your wisdom, cannot account for time and chance. Now, I think, though, that when he delivers this warning, he delivers it in a certain way. I think he leans forward on the desk, and he says to those students, time and chance are not under your control, but, and just pauses. Time and chance are not in your control, but, and he waits. And he's just waiting for them to remember what some of the research taught earlier. Because you remember right after he talked about how unpredictable life was, how we are not in control of the seasons, how they're like waves that batter us against the shore, he said this, but God has made everything appropriate in its time. He has put eternity in our hearts, but no one can discover the work that God has done from beginning to end. He leans forward and says, time and chance are not in your hands, but God is in control. This is what we've learned, that God writes the beginning and the end of the story, that what we feel is random is never random, that God is conducting a symphony and time and chance are two of the notes he plays. One of my favorite songs, poems, was written 250 years ago by a man named William Cooper, a man who struggled with great depression, great darkness, and struggled to see God's hand at work and just the struggles he felt in his own life. But he wrote these words, God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in unsearchable minds of never-failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. And so, what the teacher is trying to show the wise person is that time and chance are going to bring things into our lives that taste bitter, but remember that God is always working in his people to produce what is sweet. That God's wisdom is this unsearchable mind that even our greatest wisdom, that we will never quite understand, we'll never quite fathom what he is doing in the dark recesses of his wisdom to bring treasures out and in us. Though time and chance in our eyes appear to be cruel and unpredictable and random, they are actually servants in the hands of an almighty God, which lead us to trust his grace. In fact, he says, though time and chance may at first appear to be signs of God's displeasure, for those who know him, they will ultimately reveal his smiling face. And so to the wise, the teacher just says, keep pursuing wisdom, but don't let wisdom lead you to greater self-sufficiency. Let wisdom push you to God and His sovereign goodness and grace in your life. One comedian said, "A word to the wise ain't necessary. It's the stupid ones that need the advice." Well, that's exactly what the teacher does next. So he turns from this warning to the wise about the limits of wisdom, and now he turns to the fools and he warns them. Just imagine, right, he's in this class and he starts warning this small group of wise students, and he can almost see the wheels turning in the minds of the foolish students who are like, "And that's why I don't worry about wisdom. Like, if it doesn't control anything anyway, if bad things can still happen, then just do whatever you want. Like, what difference does it make? If you're going to die anyway, and it might end badly, just have fun. Just do whatever you feel like. Don't worry about what anyone else says." And so to those who are making foolish decisions, to those who are pursuing folly instead of wisdom, the teacher offers this warning: your choices have consequences. Your choices have consequences. So what follows is a series of proverbs that hit on all these different topics. But as we read through them, I want you to focus on two things: choices and consequences. Pay attention to the choices fools make and the consequences they suffer because of them. So let's begin in chapter 10, verse 1. "Dead flies make a perfumer's oil ferment and stink. So a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. A wise person's heart goes to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. Even when the fool walks along the road, his heart lacks sense, and he shows everyone he is a fool. If the ruler's anger rises against you, don't leave your post, for calmness puts great offenses to rest." So the fool is the person, verse 2, who chooses to do the opposite of what a wise person does. Now, going to the left instead of the right has nothing to do with politics. Don't take it out of context, right? This has everything to do with values. So the right is the right hand of the king. Think about it that way. This is a place of nobility. This is a place of honor. And so it says the wise person chooses the noble path. He chooses the honorable path. The fool always chooses sort of the selfish path. Just the thing they want. They don't care about nobility and honor. This fool is one who makes rash choices. Verse 4 describes a situation where a ruler gets angry, and he gets angry unjustly, and the fool is the one who resigns in a huff. So instead of waiting wisely for the ruler to calm down and then attempting to work through it, the fool is the one who's sitting there who gets offended, and he throws down his stuff and he leaves. Doesn't think about the future. Doesn't think about what's going to happen. He gets angry, offended, and he's out of there. I mean, what about you? Are you easily offended? That's a sign of foolishness. Can you respond to someone's unjust anger with calmness? Because that's a mark of wisdom modeled for us by Jesus, who he did not open his mouth when he was accused. Where do these choices lead? What are the consequences? Well, in a very descriptive way, we're told it's just like dead flies ruin a bottle of perfume. Imagine that gift, opening that on Valentine's Day. That's not going to go well. But it says just like that, the fool, in his choosing the dishonorable path, in his choosing the path of impatience and frustration, he just wrecks things. I almost picture him like the little brother who never builds anything with the Legos, he only destroys them. Right, who, like, if you the Jenga game gets set up, you don't play the game, you just knock it over, right? This is the fool. He ruins things. He destroys things. One of the things he destroys is his own reputation. Verse 3 says, it becomes obvious to everyone. Even when they see him walking down the street, like, there goes that fool. That's what people see. That's what people know because of his choices. Not only that, he loses his job, turns powerful people into his enemy. Look at verse 5. "There's an evil I have seen under the sun, an error proceeding from the presence of the ruler. The fool is appointed to great heights, but the rich man remains in lowly positions. I've seen slaves on horses, but princes walking on the ground like slaves." When a fool gains power, he chooses, here's his choice, he's going to appoint other fools to positions of influence. And the result is a type of social upheaval that brings chaos and disorder. In reading these verses, I thought about being in high school and learning about the French Revolution. remember learning about that in high school? And you had these people overthrow the government. They end up putting themselves in positions of power. And what happened then? Like, they just kept getting overthrown as people kept doing this over and over. Like, one fool replacing another fool, and the result is chaos and disorder. And here's the point, like moths to a flame, fools attract other fools. So students, what kind of friends do you attract? Like, so, fools are drawn to other fools, and together they pool their foolishness, and the damage increases exponentially. Do you surround yourself with those who are pursuing wisdom, who are making wise choices, so like putting who are respectful to their parents, who desire to do what they're told to do, who are industrious, who work hard? Is this the type of friend you attract, or do you attract those who are fools, those making foolish choices? So he's warning us here that if you're going to make foolish choices, you will suffer all of these unnecessary consequences. Look at verse 8. The one who digs a pit may fall into it, and the one who breaks through a wall may be bitten by a snake. The one who quarries stones may be hurt by them. The one who splits logs may be endangered by them. If the axe is dull and one does not sharpen its edges, then one must exert more strength. However, the advantage of wisdom is that it brings success. If the snake bites before it is charmed, then there is no advantage for the charmer. Here we see the fool often makes choices trying to get ahead at the expense of others. And it's so ridiculous. Like, it's not easy to dig a pit, but the fool, instead of digging a pit that could be used for something, he instead digs a pit to hope someone else falls into the pit. He instead of building a wall, he breaks down a wall, trying to move it to maybe gain more territory, to expand his boundaries. He doesn't take time to sharpen his axe. In sort of the most humorous one, it says he decides, I've got a new business idea. I'm going to be a snake charmer. But he doesn't take time to train the snake. He just goes to the market. He sits there. He starts playing his clarinet. And all of a sudden, the snake comes up and bites a customer. And it's like, you're probably not going to get paid. Right? He's always looking for a shortcut to success. And it says, in doing so, look, he keeps suffering. This is suffering you don't need to have. The wise were told, like, there's some suffering you can't prevent. Time and chance bring suffering. Wisdom won't prevent that. But he's telling us, there is a lot of suffering you can prevent by stopping making foolish decisions. Now we're going to talk about the choices the fool makes with his mouth. Look at verse 12. The words from the mouth of a wise person are gracious, but the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of the words from his mouth is folly, but the end of his speaking is evil madness. Yet the fool multiplies words. No one knows what will happen, and who can tell anyone what will happen after him? The struggles of fools weary them, for they don't know how to go to the city. It says here, the fool chooses to run his mouth. He never stops to ask what is wise or helpful. I had a teacher in eighth grade who would often, when somebody would say something, would say, is that true, kind, and necessary? Like, those are the three questions she wanted us to ask before we said something. She was encouraging us to be wise instead of being foolish. But we see here in verse 14, even the fool, though he doesn't know what he's talking about, he won't stop talking. This reminds me of one of the charges that Isaiah leveled against the nation of Israel. So in the beginning of Isaiah, the book of Isaiah, he's saying, this is why judgment is coming upon you. This is why you're about to suffer consequences. And one of the things he says is, you walk around shouting conspiracy when there are no conspiracies. Brothers and sisters, there is an epidemic of foolish talk coming from Christians as we pontificate on subjects that we know little to nothing about. 30 years ago, the promise of the internet was that we would have all of this understanding at our fingertips. But this is what we've discovered. It gives us just enough information to be loud about things that we don't understand. And so instead of spreading understanding, what we actually spread is outrage and madness. Listen, as a Christian, you need to be wise in what you say, both in person and online. Like, people say things online that they would never say if they were sitting in a coffee shop looking face to face with someone. And so before you post, tweet, or snap, you need to ask yourself, would I say it, this thing, to this person if I was sitting next to them at Cultivate Coffee? Because you see, what he's telling us here is that there are consequences for foolish talking. It spreads madness. But the madness isn't just to other people. It's the person who's most harmed is ourselves. Because this is what happens. The more we say foolish things, the more we act like a fool in the way we talk, the more we start to believe the things we're saying. Like, what are the things you say to yourself? Let's just all acknowledge, we all talk to ourselves, right? Not just me. Like, we have this is what it means to be human. We have this soul, and part of this soul is we carry on these conversations with ourselves. What do you say to yourself? Is it true? Is it wise? Is it beneficial? Or is your internal dialogue the dialogue of a fool that never shuts up? Like, that's what he's warning us about. Like, fools are like the child who's sitting in timeout and he's repeating over and over, it's unfair, no one else ever gets in trouble, this is so stupid. And we have these conversations in our head over and over and over again, and our heart starts to believe them. And notice what he says, verse 15, interesting proverb. I think it's summarizing the result, the consequences of this foolish babbling. Is that it is exhausting. So exhausting, it says, that even the simplest task now feels impossible. So you have a fool on the road. There's only one road leading into the city, but he's been jabbering to himself over and over. He's been talking to everyone else. He's been running his mouth so much that when he finally finishes, he doesn't know which way the city is. Here's what the teacher wants us to see, that wisdom is its own reward. That wisdom, it helps us bypass needless suffering. It makes decision-making simpler. Like, if you didn't do all that foolish talking, you would have been paying attention, you know the city's right over there. There's so much unnecessary pain in each of our lives that is a direct result of foolish decisions. Look at verse 16. He shows how this is bigger than just individual, it's also with larger groups. Woe to you, land, when your king is a youth. There, just think of someone immature. Your princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, land, when your king is a son of nobles and your princes feast at the proper time, for strength and not for drunkenness. Because of laziness, the roof caves in, and because of negligent hands, the house leaks. A feast is prepared for laughter, and wine makes life happy, and money is the answer for everything. Let me warn you about when you take a phrase out of context. If your life verse becomes money is the answer for everything, you're not understanding the book of Proverbs, right? We've already discussed the book of Ecclesiastes. We've discussed this over and over. Money is not the answer for everything. This is a specific point he's trying to make. And what he's saying here is that when the leaders of a nation are immature, when they party instead of going to work, then the whole land suffers. It's not just them who suffer, it's everyone they influence, it's everyone they're responsible for. Because of their foolish choices, the nation, like a home, like a house, verse 18, falls into a state of disrepair. On the other hand, if you have a country that is run by those who are wise, then it has the money available both to keep the house up for routine maintenance, but also for those things that bring extra joy to people, like times of feasting and celebration, verse 19. So the resources that come from wise leadership are able to provide for everything that's needed. Now, friends, this is why we pray for God to appoint wise leaders to our town, to our state, to our country. In fact, we're commanded to do this as Christians. We're told to pray for those in authority over us. Why? Because their wise leadership blesses the land. It allows us to live lives of peace, lives of godliness in quiet. So wise leadership blesses everyone. This is also why we need to appoint wise leaders in church. And why Wherever you are in a position of authority or influence, you need to be a wise leader because your actions affect others. Your choices have consequences that extend beyond you. They extend to your family. Men, the choices you make, whether sinful or wise, affect your wife and kids. Do you want a home that is not in disrepair? Then make wise choices. That's what he's saying. In other words, you can't make foolish choices as a husband and father and look at your house that's caved in and say, well, time and chance. He's like, no. That one's not time and chance. That's your stupid decisions. If you are in any position of leadership and influence, your choices have consequences not just for you, but for those who follow you. The final verse of chapter 10 summarizes the consequence of being a fool. It does so in this proverbial way. It subtly refers to an illicit encounter where pillow talk is shared, and the conversation shared makes its way eventually to the ears of the king, and what was foolishly discussed in a moment of passion now has these life-changing consequences. Verse 20, do not curse the king even in your thoughts, and do not curse a rich person even in your bedroom. For a bird of the sky may carry the message, and a winged creature may report the matter. So let me summarize verse 20. What happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas. Be sure your sin will find you out. If you sow foolish choices, you will reap painful consequences. Jesus gave a very similar warning. There's nothing covered that won't be uncovered. Nothing hidden that won't be made known. Therefore, whatever you have said in the dark will be heard in the light. And what you have whispered in an ear in private rooms will be proclaimed on the housetops. There is no such thing as secret sin. So listen to me. If you are sinning right now and no one knows, then you will be tempted to keep sinning. You will convince yourself that you will get away with it. You're different than everyone else who got caught. Listen, that is one of the single stupidest things you could ever say. Like the fool, the ultimate mark of a fool is this: they say there is no God. The fool is the one who says, no one knows what I'm doing. No one will ever find out. No one will ever hold me accountable. I'll be fine. See, but there is a God, and he does see. And he will bring it to light. And so if you are sinning in secret, listen, it's not in secret. Repent today because it will be found out. And the consequences grow more and more severe the longer it goes. Today, confess your sin. Today, ask for help. Today, turn from the path of foolishness and all of the painful consequences and walk in the way of wisdom and blessing. Listen, any one of us can be a fool, and any of us can be a fool at any time. In this chapter, we see the fool walking, leading, working, speaking, and feasting. Foolishness creeps into our everyday life. Foolishness comes out on the weekday as well as the weekend. And so take the teacher's warning to heart. He's saying, your choices have consequences. So what's the point of all this? Like, what's the teacher trying to teach us in this chapter and a half? I think he's preparing us for the final exam. And the final exam only has one question. Do you ever get an exam that only has one question? It's the worst kind of exam. I'd rather have an exam with hundreds of questions. You get a lot wrong and still be okay. Like, one question, better get it right. So he's saying there's a final exam. He has one question. The question is, what is the whole duty of man? And he's going to tell us, chapter 12, that you fill in two blanks. One question, two answers, two-part answer. It's this: you fear God and you keep his commands. What's the whole duty of man? Do what Adam and Eve were first commanded to do: fear God and keep his commands. And so for the wise person, he's saying, fear God. Recognize you're not God. Recognize that you aren't in control of what will happen to you. So stop trying to manage your life through your own wisdom and effort. Understand, suffering's going to come. You live outside the Garden of Eden. Suffering will come, and your wisdom can't prevent all suffering. Like, that's in God's hands. Fear God. And then to the fool, he says, and keep his commands. He's saying, you know, you want to know why life is so hard for you? Because you're not keeping his commands. Like, God has prepared a way for you to walk, and he says this way of walking brings more blessing. It avoids a lot of consequences. You're not walking this way, you're walking that way. So stop walking that way, instead keep his commands. Like, walk in the way God says. You'll find blessing instead of suffering. But here's the problem. We have hearts just like Adam and Eve. We have hearts that would rather trust ourselves and choose our own way than to fear God and keep his commands. Right? I mean, we could all agree with this, couldn't we? Yeah, I should trust God when difficult things come to my life. Yeah, I should do what he says. That's smarter than not doing what he says. But then we go and we don't trust God. We trust ourselves. We don't do what he says. We do what we feel like. I mean, this is why Jesus came. Jesus came so that our hearts of sin could be replaced with hearts of faith. In Jesus, we have died to sin. We've been raised to life in him. And so the only way for us to walk this path of wisdom, the path that fears God and keeps his commands, is to walk with Jesus. Like, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. He has become to us wisdom. Jesus told a story. If you grew up in church, been in church a long time, you're probably familiar with it. But I think it summarizes what the teacher is saying in these chapters. It's the story of two men building houses. And one man builds a house on the sand. One man builds a house on stone, on a rock. And then it tells us the wind starts blowing off the sea, and with it comes a storm. Maybe in the words of Ecclesiastes, this is time and chance. You can build a great house, storms still come. But what happens when the storm reaches? It says the one who builds it on the sand, his house is destroyed. But the one who builds on a rock, like, his house stands. Maybe it takes a beating. Maybe it's fearful, but it stands. And then Jesus says, as he explains this story, the one who builds his house on the sand, he's the fool. And why is he a fool? Because he doesn't build his life on my teaching, on my work. He builds it on his own. And he says the one who builds it on stone, this is the wise man, because he builds his life on me, on what I've said, on who I am. I mean, friends, this is what he's telling us. God is saying this. Listen, you can't prevent all the suffering in your life. It's not in your hands. Listen, you can prevent a lot of it. Like, so be wise. Walk the way of Jesus. The way of Jesus is better than walking away from him. It brings blessing instead of all this needless pain and suffering that sin brings. So walk the way of Jesus. But understand, even walking the way of Jesus, storms blowing off the sea. Time and chance happen. But rest in this, that if you walk the way of Jesus, if you fear God, if you build your life on what Jesus says, then even though suffering happens in this broken world, Jesus keeps you standing. And nothing this world can throw at us, if our life is built on Jesus, can ultimately knock us down. Will you pray with me? Father, help us. Help us to pursue a life of wisdom, a life of keeping your commands, knowing that this is the wise way to live, that it avoids so much needless pain and suffering that comes from sin. I pray for the person in here right now who's got hidden sin. They're trying to manage it. They're trying to control it. Lord, I pray that today they would repent and they would receive your grace and walk the way of wisdom. They would turn to the right instead of the left. Lord, I pray for us, those in here who are trying to walk in wisdom, trying to follow Jesus in his grace, trying to walk in his strength, and are feeling some of that wind blowing off the sea, the winds of time and chance are hitting them, and they're suffering in some ways. Lord, I pray that they too will trust Jesus, that his grace will allow them to stand. Father, help us. Help us to fear you, to keep your commands. Help us do this by the power of Jesus at work in our hearts. I pray this in his name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message from Redeemer Community Church in Fuquay-Varina, North Carolina. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. For more sermons, we invite you to visit us online at redeemernc.org.